Welcome into the Whole Hog Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Campbell. Today's episode is number 2 in a 7-part series Whole Hog is doing to look back at the past decade in Razorback sports. Matt Jones joins the show this week, and he wanted to talk all about Hog baseball. Unfortunately, Matt and I got a little carried away, so the entire conversation didn't make the cut. But fortunately for you, the entire audio of Matt's interview will be available on the same podcast channel if you're interested. Just subscribe, it'll appear in your section and play now in podcasts that you haven't listened to. Listen, he said so many good things, I couldn't bear taking them all away from you. So look for that entire conversation to drop later. Also, we didn't forget about the basketball team. Kentucky beat writer Jerry Tipton joins the show to talk about the Cats and Hogs in Bud Walton Arena. Then, the show ends with Scotty Bordelon and myself breaking down the Razorbacks' last 2 games with a preview of the basketball podcast of Mid-America. Okay, now that we got all of that out of the way, let's get started. Welcome into the Whole Hog Podcast, round 2 this time, and I'm going to be joined by Matt Jones, writer for Whole Hog Sports. Last week, if you didn't get that episode, make sure to go back and listen. It was Tom Murphy, and Tom and I sat down and we talked about some of the great moments of the past decade, and you know, some of these are just things that come to the top of every Razorback fan's memory. Things like the Henry Heave, the 2010 Sugar Bowl, and then Tom was there to cover the 2018 College World Series, so he was there for almost 2 weeks basically. And so if you didn't catch up with that podcast, make sure to go back and listen to that one. It was really good information. It'll be a nice trip down memory lane for us and Razorback fans. But this week we got Matt Jones coming on, and Matt, you write a lot. He was at all those events talking, you know, he writes on wholehogsports.com. So we just wanted to start, and as we were trying to kind of weed through what we wanted to talk about, because as we said, Matt is there at almost everything, we decided that we would focus kind of on a baseball perspective here. So let's start at the beginning of the decade. And it seems it was 10 years ago, so some of this stuff almost just slips from your memory. Yeah. But the 2010 and 2011 seasons really ended in the same place, Matt.
Yeah, they did. They both ended in Tempe, Arizona, at Arizona State, at their old stadium. I think it was Packard Stadium on the Tempe campus. Really one of the, when you think about the history of Arizona State, it to have a stadium like they had for all those years, it just kind of blows your mind. And, you know, it's really eye-opening when you go out there too, when you're used to being around the SEC and you go to places like LSU and Alabama and Texas A&M and all these places. And I'm not talking about football, I'm talking about baseball. Those places will fill up for baseball games, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, and you go on down the list. And then you go to a place like Arizona State, who early in the decade, they really had it rolling under Pat Murphy, and then Tim Esmay replaced him after he was fired for some NCAA violations. You go there, it's like a 3,000-seat stadium, which in the Pac-12 is a big stadium, but it really is eye-opening just how much professional influence there is in a town like Phoenix. And you got a great program in Arizona State, and there's just not a lot of fan support. I remember Arkansas was playing Arizona State in the regional in 2011. It was the regional championship game. There must have been 600 open seats. And I remember Robbie Neiswanger, who wrote for the Arkansas News Bureau, was sitting next to me, and I looked at Robbie and I said, can you imagine if this game was in Fayetteville tonight? The place would be packed. It would be overflow. There would be people being turned away at the gates. And but yeah, both of those seasons ended in Tempe. It was hot. If I remember correctly, I think it was a little bit more hot for the regional than it was the super regional. And part of that had to do with the super regionals were night games. And so it cooled off a little bit relative to you know, to Arizona in June. It cooled off. It was cooler for those games. I remember the regional, we sat up on top of the press box. Go back to, you know, how much emphasis is put on college baseball in Arizona. And if I remember right about that press box in Arizona, there were 8 seats in the press box. So
8 seats.
There were 2 for home radio. There were 2 for away radio. There were 2 for television, basically two for television. Now, remember, in that time, not a lot of their games got televised.
Right. So
what they essentially did was they took away two, you know, media seats and put TV there. And then there were the sports information directors for both teams and maybe a scorekeeper.
Yeah, somebody's got to keep the scoreboard or something, right?
Yeah, so maybe there were 10 seats in there. It was a very small press box, though. And so everybody else was up on top of the press box. In June, with the sun beating down in Phoenix, 110, 115 degrees, and it was a doubleheader the final day because Arkansas had gotten into the loser's bracket. They had lost to Charlotte, I believe, in the first game of the regional, and so they got put in the loser's bracket. On that Sunday, they had to play two games, and I remember in between games thinking my computer was going to blow up. Aaron Peters, who used to be on KNWA here in Northwest Arkansas, I remember he had a towel over his head sitting underneath this little desk that was on top. Basically, it was a folding table up on top of the press box putting together his highlight package because it was so hard to see your computer and it was so hot. And, you know, certainly one of the hottest games that I've ever been to. And, yeah, there's all kinds of fun stories like that when you come to college baseball. I think the 2010 team gets forgotten at Arkansas because they didn't make the World Series. That was a really good baseball team. Andy Wilkins, James McCann, Drew Smiley, Zach Cox, Brett Eibner, Mike Bolsinger, a lot of really, really good players. DJ Baxendale was a freshman on that team. Really good team that I think kind of gets forgotten because it didn't make the College World Series. That's the only team that Dave has had since he's been at Arkansas that got to the Super Regional and didn't make it to Omaha.
Moving on now through the decade, all of a sudden there's a huge rule change that happens in college baseball. They start to move to these BB core bats.
Yeah, in 2011.
You're not hitting home runs anymore. And it was almost at the University of Arkansas. It's like Dave and his staff knew that this was coming because they did.
Yeah.
And they've just put a huge emphasis on pitching.
Yeah.
And it came out in that 2012 season with that team that if they allowed two runs, they were going to lose.
Yeah, and you really saw it in 2011 because that's when some of those pitchers – like Ryan Stanek and Barrett Aston and Brandon Moore, they were all freshmen in 2011. Talk about Tempe. You really saw the potential in Ryan Stanek in an elimination game there. They actually got rematched with Charlotte in the loser's bracket on a Sunday. And Ryan Stanek pitched nine innings, pitched a complete game and sent them into, you know, pitched well enough that they weren't, that they didn't have to use all their arms. And it was like a perfect scenario going into that night game. Now they lost to Arizona State and Arizona State lost to Texas in the Super Regionals in Austin. But you could really see that there was going to be something special about Stanek, I thought, in that game in Tempe. And then, yeah, you're right, over the next three, 4 years, it became a pitching school. In 2013, they had a 1.89 team ERA. It was the lowest in 37 years in college baseball. Connecticut in, I think, 1976 had set the record. And that was the only program that had had a better ERA than Arkansas had in 2013. But there wasn't a lot of hitting. There weren't a lot of hitters that came through here in those years. In 2011, that was the first year after the bat change. Arkansas had hit 92 home runs in 2010, if I remember it right. And I think they hit like 48 in 2011. And a lot of those were James McCann. James McCann had this really great junior season before he got drafted in the second round by the Tigers, had that walk-off home run against LSU that everyone remembers at Baum Stadium. That's probably one of the top five games that I can remember ever being at over there at Baum. And but yeah, you saw a real lack of hitting there for a number of years. Matt Reynolds was here. He had some good seasons at the plate. Tyler Spoon had a really good year in there at one point. Brian Anderson had a pretty good year, I think, as a junior. But man, outside of that, those were some lean years. That team in 2012 that went to the World Series, that was a pitching team. I mean, it was all pitching and defense. You remember they beat Baylor in the game three of the Super Regional 1-0 in 10 innings. One of the most incredible games I've ever been at, because Randall Fant started the game for Arkansas and he just kept putting them in these bad situations. Would load the bases, and then he would get out of it. He would make a play, or someone behind him, a Tim Carver, a Bo Bigham, somebody like that would make a play. And it was just a really cool run for them to get into the World Series. They beat South Carolina in the second game of the World Series that year, broke South Carolina's 22-game NCAA tournament winning streak. And, course, lost to South Carolina in the semifinals. But that team had a .281 batting average, and they made it basically to they were the number three team in the nation at the end. And had it not been for, you know, some questionable strike calls by Perry Costello, they might have been the national champion or the national runner-up with a .281 batting average. And it's really a testament to what Dave Jorn did with that pitching staff.
That team sticks out to me is that they did have the pitching. They had really what you needed that could be consistent going no matter really where you went, that you knew that these guys were only going to give up 2-3 runs in a game. Yeah. And it's a bitter ending for that team, because you felt like if they could have won that South Carolina game, that, you know, they had an opportunity there for the national championship for sure.
That was the team that had a lot of games where they scored one or two runs. And I can't remember if it was the 2012 team, might have been the 13 team or the 14 team. There was a team in there that, if I remember right, they played 23 one-run games. 23, or maybe it was 1 and 2 run games. But it was like every game was tied. And so there was so much there was so much pressure put on that pitching staff. And we mentioned some of them, Aston and Moore and Baxendale, but, Colby Suggs was on those teams, turned into a great reliever. Nolan Sanburn was drafted after his sophomore year in 2011. I remember at Baylor, I remember watching him throw an 88-mile-an-hour changeup and thinking, oh, my God, this is incredible for, a college pitcher to have that type of arm strength. And it was such a raw, such a great raw talent that he had. And yeah, that pitching staff was, I don't know that you'll ever see another one like it, because the balls have changed now to where you're starting to see the runs coming back in college baseball. The bats haven't really changed a whole lot. They still got those BB core standards, but by lowering the seams on the baseball, it's made the baseballs jump off the bats quite a bit more. I think that happened in maybe Benintendi's the year that he won National Player of the Year was the year that they changed the baseballs. And so if you ever see a team have a sub-2 ERA again in college baseball, enjoy it, because it's not going to be one of those things that you see very often.
Just a few more questions here, Matt, as we wrap it up on the Whole Hog podcast. We're going to cheat a little bit. We're going to include the 2009 team in here. But from 2009 until 2019, the Arkansas Razorbacks went to 5 College World Series, 09, 12, 15, 18, and 19. I think we all know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. Which team was the best out of all those?
Well, I mean, it had to be the 2018 team because of the way that they, the way that they finished their season. That was a great team. They had, such good players. I think you're going to see a lot of the players that were on that team go on and have good pro careers, whether it be the freshmen who were there that year, like Heston Kerstad and Casey Martin, maybe a Casey Opitz. I think Blaine Knight's got potential. I think Isaiah Campbell has a really great potential. Matt Cronin, too, of being, great big league players. That was the best team. It had to have been the best team. That was the most dominant team, at least. You can't say they were dominant because they had that weird road thing that went on that year where they didn't win any road series. But I thought they were a dominant team. I just thought that, some of those road series, quirky things happened in some of those games. And it was also a perfect storm that year that I think they played 3 national seeds plus LSU at their home parks in the year that they were national seeds. And that was a really good team. I think from a talent standpoint, from what they were able to accomplish, that had to be the best team that they've had so far. Probably the best team they've ever had in school history.
Runner up, would you say, would be the 09 team? That team was pretty stout too. Keuchel on the mound.
Yeah, I think about the Virginia game. I don't know if it would be runner up, but you think about the Virginia game when they had Keuchel, Bolsinger, and Smiley pitching to McCann. Those are 3 big league pitchers and a big league catcher all in the same game. From a talent standpoint, that was a really good team. Zach Cox was a first rounder. Andy Wilkins played in the big leagues. Brett Eibner played in the big leagues. That was a really talented team. But I still think 2010 might have been a more talented team, because really all they lost off that 09 season was Keuchel. And they added some really good players for 2010, like Baxendale and Matt Reynolds. Matt Reynolds played in the big leagues some and still playing in AAA. So That's why I say that 2010 team, I think, gets a little overlooked just because they didn't make it to the College World Series. They ran into a really good Arizona State team, and they lost 2 12-inning games. And that's the only reason I think we don't remember them as well as we do some of those others.
Yeah, the thing that sticks out to me in that 09 team is just, you know, the major leaguers that you said they were on that team.
But that team wasn't that good. I mean, not to say it was a bad team. It was a weird year because they got ranked number one middle of the season, and then they just fell off the face of the earth.
Because didn't they beat Arizona State in a midweek?
They beat Arizona State twice. Yeah, that was now we're going back into, I guess, 3 decades ago. Yeah. But they beat Arizona State twice in the midweek, and both of those games were packed at bomb. And they're really nice weather. You didn't know what you were going to get late March, early April in a midweek, and it turned out to be two beautiful nights, and Arkansas won a couple of one-run games against Arizona State. And they won that one, and then kind of late April they began to really slip, and they lost their last 8 SEC games, went to Hoover, won a couple of times, went on the road, won 3 in Norman, won 2 in Tallahassee, and then won 2 in Omaha. A lot of people forget that. They beat Cal State Fullerton and Virginia, and they lost to LSU twice the year that LSU won the national championship.
Yeah, if that team didn't have to play LSU.
Yeah, but you know, you've seen that's kind of been the hallmark of these Van Horn teams that we remember the best. You haven't seen it the last couple of years because they've been so good in the regular season that they played their games at home in the regional and the super regional, and they've been so good at home. That's really been something in the last 3 years that has been it's something I've really noticed, is just the level of a home field advantage that BOM has become for the Razorbacks, because they don't lose there very often. I think they've lost there maybe 12 times, 13 times in the last 3 years. That's incredible. There are teams who will lose 13 times at home this year, good teams. You know, teams that might make the postseason that will lose a lot of game, double-digit games at home. Arkansas just doesn't lose at BOM very often. They don't lose a lot of series there. And that even goes back into even in 16, they were winning a lot of home series, up to a certain point. I think when Missouri came here, they'd won like 10 straight series at home that year. But going back to the original thought that I was having, when they've made the postseason a lot of times under Van Horn, it's because they've gone on the road and they've really grown as a team. And you see Arkansas, the way the SEC does its schedule is it really it focuses on final schedules at schools in putting together the end of year schedule, the regular season schedule. So Arkansas is always on the road. People ask, why is Arkansas always on the road at the end of the year? Well, it has to do with how their final schedule relates to other final schedules. You've got to be at home when the finals are ending, which is always Mother's Day weekend at Arkansas. You know, so Arkansas is always playing a home game when they're having graduation on campus. Well, that's why. And then they go on the road at the end of the year. And it's something about it, whether they've gone to Knoxville or College Station or Athens, or Dave gets that team on the road. They go to that last regular season site. Then he takes them to Hoover. And sometimes they're on the road for like 12 or 13 days. They might come back and get a change of clothes, and then they're off again to Houston or Norman or Stillwater for a regional. And then a lot of times they're on the road for a super regional, Waco, Tallahassee. And something about being on the road together has made those teams come really close and get really good late in the year. And I think that's been something that's been kind of interesting for me to watch, is just how they've made the World Series a lot of times as a team that has had to, you know, do it the hard way by going to a couple of different sites before they get to Omaha.
The decade has ended. Arkansas is going into 2020. What was your you covered every single season in that decade. What was your favorite game
to cover? Had to be the Missouri State game in 2017, the game that went till 3 o'clock in the morning. I think I'm one of the only sports writers who can ever say they've been at a 4 a.m. press conference, because that's when we were doing our interviews after that game. It was incredible. You remember that Arkansas was in the loser's bracket, and so they had to beat ORU that afternoon, and there had been storms in the area all weekend. The games have been being delayed and postponed. Arkansas's game against ORU, I think, was delayed by about 2 hours. And so they didn't finish that game until 6 o'clock, 6:30, somewhere in there. And so the Missouri State game was a late starting game as it was. And then the rain comes, like 10:35, 10:45, something like that. And it's like, surely. And we were looking at the radar. There was rain well back into Oklahoma. And you're looking at the radar saying, you know, surely this is it. I mean, they're going to come up here in 15 minutes and say, hey, you know, go home. We're going to resume this thing in the morning. And then if they have to play again tomorrow night, they will. Well, 15 minutes goes by, nothing. 30 minutes goes by, nothing. 45 minutes, nothing. You start to think, it's like, are they really going to restart this game? Are they really going to? And they did. And the game restarts at, I think, 12:05, 12:10, something like that in the morning. John Williams, who's the public address announcer, I remember he, you know, kind of said, it's breakfast at Baum, you know, good morning, everyone. And so it was just, you've never seen a game like that. I don't know if there's ever been a college baseball game like that. And then not just the time, but the way that game played out. A lot of people forget that after it restarted in the fourth inning, third inning, something like that, it took another 3+ hours to play. A lot of, you know, a lot of lead changes, a lot of game ties, things like that. And then when Jared Gates hit the home run that gave Arkansas a two-run advantage, or three, I think it was a three-run advantage. I think they had already taken the lead. But when he gave him that home run that kind of gave him the cushion, there were 3,000 people in the stadium, something like that, maybe 35. I've never heard the stadium that loud. I've never heard the stadium that loud when there were 12,000 people in there. And I just think it was because for all the people who were still in the crowd, it was like this elation of, oh my God, I stayed here and look at what I'm seeing. You know, it paid off that I'm staying here. And you had so many people. I saw bank executives. I saw people who owned, you know, small businesses at the leaving the ballpark at, you know, 3:15 that morning, who had to be at work at 8, and they were coming back out the next night. And it was just such a really neat thing to see, because, you know, you're never going to see another game like that. For me personally, I got home about 4:15, 4:30, and I wrote my story, and I think I hit published, or had a game story, but then I wrote kind of a commentary on the night. I think I hit published about 8 a.m. and crashed for about 4 hours. And the next night was really rough because I don't remember a lot about that one. I didn't sleep a lot. It was hot. And, you know, that I don't remember a lot about Missouri State eliminating Arkansas, but I remember, and I don't think I'll ever forget. And I don't think anyone who was ever there will ever forget being there at 3 a.m. in the rain and Arkansas beating Missouri State. That was, even if Missouri State had won that game, I still think you remember that game because you're just never going to see another game like that.
Matt, it was a pleasure to talk to you here on the Whole Hog Podcast. Tons of information. All, you know, we kind of really went on the Arkansas baseball stuff, and it was so good to just get some insider information about what you've seen over the past decade. I can't have a really long answer here, Matt, but I do want to ask you before we get off, looking ahead to 2020, in these next 10 years, do you see this program being set up to where they win that national title?
Well, they're going to be in position to, you know, be a national championship contender. The problem is that you have so many other teams that are doing really well right now. I mean, you look around college baseball, there's 6, 7, 8 teams that are like Arkansas, even some that maybe you don't think about, like a Texas Tech, you know, who keeps getting back to Omaha almost every year, and they're set up to have great teams. But with the way that Arkansas has been recruiting, they're going to be in position to – you know, give themselves a shot to win a national championship. We'll see. I read in the Omaha World Herald when Nebraska played Arkansas once, one of the World Herald guys came down and interviewed Van Horn, and he said, I'm going to win this damn thing one day. And I just think that, you know, there's that drive that they're going to win this thing. And maybe it never happens. Maybe Dave has the same faith that Norm DeBrien had, and a second place team is going to be the best team that he ever had. But I think that with there's that drive, and with the way they've been recruiting and the facilities and the, you know, the resources that they put into their program, they're going to have as good of a chance to win a national championship in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years as anyone in the country.
All right, Matt. Thanks so much. I just had a ton of good information, and you can check out all of Matt's work on wholehogsports.com. He's writing a preview right now for Arkansas baseball in 2020, so he will get you set. And those expectations, if you're a Razorback fan out there, you can just have them increase and increase all throughout. Thanks, Matt. Welcome back into the Whole Hog Podcast. Seth Campbell joined alongside Jerry Tipton. And Jerry is a writer and covers Kentucky basketball for the Lexington Herald. Jerry, it was a disappointing game for the Wildcats, an 81-78 finish off a buzzer beater. Just walk me through what happened in this game, because Kentucky had a bit sizable lead in the second half.
Yeah, it was a very, it was a strange game, and it perfectly fit a strange season, it seems like, where just generally around the country you should expect the unexpected, and that's what it was last night. South Carolina, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they made like seven or nine of 36 shots, something like that, in the first half, and everything was a labor for them. And Kentucky took the lead at the start. I think South Carolina missed their first 10 shots. And Kentucky led by as much as 14, 5 minutes into the second half. And then the game changed. South Carolina made a couple of threes. They had a putback dunk, something like that. The crowd got into it. And the whole tenor, the tenor of the game changed. And South Carolina made like 20 of 36 shots in the second half, something like that. I mean, they shot a lot better and pulled it out with, like you say, a buzzer beater right at the end. They led by like five with less than a minute to go and missed some free throws. Kentucky ties it. So I'm thinking with 4 seconds to go, and I'm thinking the game's going to go into overtime. And South Carolina rushes down. The guy throws up a three from near the top of the key and banks it in. And he said afterwards that he thought he shot an air ball, but it went in, and South Carolina won.
Man, you hate to lose games or have players lose games off of a bank shot, and it's almost a terrible way to win or lose a game. But Arkansas has been on the right side of that this year as well, against a game against Georgia Tech where Mason Jones banked one in at the buzzer to win. South Carolina scored 56 second half points. You kind of mentioned it; they went on a streak. Was that due to Kentucky defense, or was that just the offense for South Carolina heating up?
Well, it's probably a combination, but Kentucky's defense has been pretty good. That's been probably the steadiest part of their game. They've got a guy like Nick Richards guarding the basket as a rim protector, and Ashton Hagans. They have three guards that are pretty good on defense and offense. Ashton Hagans, Tyrese Maxey, and Emmanuel Quickley. And, I don't know what to say besides just about every game Kentucky's played against a medium to quality opponent has come down to the last 5 or 6 minutes. And they've gotten better at executing in those situations. But if you play a 4 or 5, 6 minute game, anything can happen, and anybody could win a 5 minute game. And that's kind of what I thought watching the game last night, is that they were in a position where, and John Calipari kind of touched on this afterwards, that they were in a position where they could have put the hammer down and gotten up by 20, but they didn't do it. And his big theme after in the post game press conference was discipline. He didn't think, the team was as disciplined as he would like at both ends of the court. And on defense in particular, he's got a thing about corner threes. He doesn't want to let the other team have open corner threes. South Carolina made two or three of those in the second half that helped fuel the comeback.
So Kentucky has had, like you said earlier in the interview, as we were talking to Jerry Tipton, writer for the Lexington Herald Leader,
Kentucky has had an up and down season, like everybody seems like in college basketball. What has been, I guess, something that they've focused on that hasn't gone well in the games when they've lost to somebody like Evansville or when they lose a game to South Carolina, but when they win games like against Louisville and Michigan State, what's been the difference in those games?
Well, one thing that's kind of been a thing that we've been watching is three-point shooting. They're not, they've got a guy, Quickly is really on a tear right now. The last three or four games, I mean, you know, he's really shot well. Nobody else has joined him. And so teams that when they don't have to worry about the three-point shooting, then they can defend more on the drive. Kentucky likes to drive a lot, which is kind of a John Calipari signature approach to basketball. And they want to draw fouls, get to the foul line. Going into the game last night, I thought it was perfectly set up for Kentucky to romp for a change because South Carolina had been fouling a lot. So Kentucky gets to the line, you think. And Kentucky's one of the nation's best free throw shooting teams. Their accuracy, I think they were in the top five, I believe. They didn't shoot them particularly well last night. And South Carolina turns the ball over. And Kentucky's at their best running in transition up and down. And so I thought that was, I thought it was set up for Kentucky to win fairly handily. And, of course, that's not what happened.
Coming into this game, Arkansas versus Kentucky, if you look at the teams, you know, Kentucky is just going to be a bigger team, and they've been able to really – out-rebound Arkansas in past matchups, and this one doesn't seem to be any different because Arkansas is small. They play with a smaller lineup all the way around. From Kentucky's perspective, how are they going? What's the plan for them to guard guys like Jones and Joe and Jimmy Witt with the smaller length that they have?
Well, they're not sharing their game plans with me, unfortunately, as much as I encourage them to do so. I think their defense, they'll tell you, starts with Ashton Hagans on the ball. They want him to disrupt the other team's point guard or the other team's facilitator in getting the offense going. So that's one matchup that I would look for. And they like Maxey and Quickly as defenders. Quickly was on Jordan Wara of Louisville. He had that was a game they won, and Wara had 20 or more points in every game. He only had 8 in that game. So, and they take a certain pride in defense. And of course, Nick Richards is in the back line to guard the rim. So that would be something that I would anticipate. Of course, I was completely wrong about the South Carolina game and how I thought that was going to go. But I'm even more confident about that being a critical phase of whatever happens on Saturday.
Kentucky under Calipari, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but they are really good after a loss. Why do you think that it is that under Calipari, Kentucky can bounce back and win games after losing?
Well, you know, that I think their pride is stung a little bit. I mean, Kentucky's got a pretty good record in all sorts of games.
Right.
Over the years, and that's one category that it is true. I would point out that they lost back-to-back games in Las Vegas to Utah, which was a game that I think they expected to win, maybe to a fault. And then they lost to Ohio State, both of those games in Las Vegas, both of them that coming down to the last 4 or 5 minutes, possession by possession game. And they've gotten better at executing. Probably last night was a step back in that regard.
All right, Jerry, as we wrap it up here on the Whole Hog Podcast, we're talking to Jerry Tipton, writer for the Lexington Herald Leader. You can check out everything that he's writing in preparation for this Arkansas game and all throughout the season on the Lexington Herald Leader website, heraldleader.com. Jerry, there's a lot of hype in Fayetteville right now around Arkansas. They've only lost 2 games. And, you know, Kentucky has a target on their back, it seems like, for everybody else in the SEC. I pose the question to you, is there a team that Kentucky likes to beat more than any other team in the SEC, or have they just not found that rival yet?
Well, it's, you know, if we're talking long term, it's changed over the years, and it's always whatever team poses the most serious threat, or at least the threat that's perceived as the most serious. Now, going back a ways, you know, Tennessee, Florida, when Billy Donovan was there and they were winning national championships, Arkansas during the time Nolan Richardson, especially those early years when Arkansas was in the league, LSU, Dale Brown. So it sort of varies. The constant is Kentucky, of course.
Right.
They've won over 1,000 SEC regular season games. I think it's almost 250 more than anybody else all time. So, you know, so they're an entity unto themselves. And right at the present time, I'm not sure that team, probably Auburn, more so just because they knocked them out of the NCAA tournament last March. And Bruce Pearl, there's a certain air, there's a certain something in the air there that they would like to beat him. So if I had to guess, I would say that more than any other team. But John Calipari, in so many words, has said more than once that, and I'm not even paraphrasing, I'm just interpreting, and I could be wrong, that Kentucky's not good enough to just sort of waltz in and beat anybody really in the league. And so they need to be pepped up to especially on the road. And I would think after losing last night that they'll be pepped up to play Arkansas.
I would assume so too, after, as you said, losing, and it's going to be a great atmosphere in Bud Walton Arena, and both teams are looking to solidify themselves atop the league. Jerry, thanks so much for taking the time and coming on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No problem. That's Jerry Tipton, writer and covers Kentucky basketball for the Lexington Herald. Make sure to check out his stuff online, heraldleader.com.
As with the earlier conversation with Matt Jones, Scotty and myself got a little long-winded talking about the Basketball Hogs. If you want to check out our entire conversation, I encourage you to listen to the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America. Scotty and I's complete analysis is featured there. But now, without further ado, here's a preview of the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America.
All right, true or false, Scotty, if I told you that Mason Jones would have 1 point and Arkansas would win by 20 over Vanderbilt, would you believe me?
Maybe against Vanderbilt, but any other team, no, not at all. I think the Vanderbilt game ended the most consistent scoring stretch that Mason's had in his Arkansas career. I think he was in double figures his previous six games. He'd never scored in double figures in more than three consecutive games before for this little stretch for him. But he did so many other things pretty well. Like, he finished with eight assists too.
That's what we were gonna get to for sure, is that Mason scored 1 point. And if you were talking about Mason from last year, I think that would have affected his entire game.
Right.
That you would have seen him only play, you know, maybe 20 minutes tops. He wouldn't have gotten into the rebounding column, into the assist column. But the growth we were talking about from Desi, we've also seen from Mason. He had 1 point, but Mason did not play bad whatsoever. In fact, he had a plus minus of 17.
Is that team best? It's got to be up there. I remember at one point during the game, we were talking about it. He hadn't scored yet, but he was like still a plus 17.
Yes, and Witt came in with 20, a plus 20, and then Sills ended up with a plus 19. So his third best, and he had 1 point. That's growth from that man right there.
Yeah, he's just finding ways to manufacture points. And I think we've mentioned it earlier, like sometimes you can tell what kind of day Mason is going to have in terms of scoring the ball, like in the first few minutes of the game, because a lot of times he's going to be the guy that lets that first shot fly on Arkansas's first possession. And it's almost always going to come from the left wing. It might be a catch and shoot, or it might be one of his patented step backs that he's so good at. But sometimes you can kind of see if he's going to have a good scoring day, just kind of right off the bat. he didn't have a shot going at all. And I think it, when he saw like his first four or five shots miss, he kind of got a little bit hesitant, and Eric Musselman was pissed. At one point, Mason catches on the left wing, like literally as close from me and you to Musselman, and didn't let the shot fly from the left wing. He's wide open, and he didn't let it go. And I asked Musselman after the game, I said, did you think that Mason was maybe a little bit too passive? And he said, well, I don't know if you can read lips or not, but at one point I was telling him that he needs to shoot the ball.
In those exact words, right?
Yeah, and Seth, I think, can read lips, and he saw the whole thing happen. But yeah, he was a little bit passive at times, but you can't. I think he understood that he just didn't have it. Like, he just didn't have his touch. He looked to set up teammates, maybe to a fault at times, because some of the entry feeds that he was giving teammates were, you know, getting deflected or knocked out of bounds, whatnot. Still finished with 8 assists. And over the last two games, he's got 17. And you look at his KenPom page, he's got the 6th best assist rate in the conference through 4 league games. He's assisting on over 30% of Arkansas's scores when he's on the floor, which is a terrific mark.
Chaney will be the second option after Bailey now. And Bailey hasn't had just a fantastic 2 or 3 game stretch here. I mean, he's done his role. Don't get me wrong about that, but
he's not been a net negative at any point.
He just seems to be getting sometimes in foul trouble, getting quick, easy fouls that he doesn't agree with necessarily and are kind of 50-50 calls, but they've been going against him recently. But Chaney, 14 points, was a key cog for the Razorbacks, the second leading scorer on the team against Vanderbilt. And maybe this is a coming out party for Reggie.
Yeah, we saw earlier in the year too, I forget which game it was, but I remember after that game, I think Reggie finished with like 5 points, 11 boards, and several assists. And I'm like, I asked Musselman after the game, I was like, can this be a springboard for Reggie? Well, turns out it really wasn't. He had a really rough stretch against Texas A&M and LSU, had the technical foul at LSU, and then against Texas A&M's first three times he touches the ball, turns the ball over. And so he's kind of, after that LSU game, in the doghouse a little bit. But I liked the energy that he played with at Ole Miss too, even though he didn't really, like, you looked at the box score, he's probably not the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth guy that you look at. I thought he played okay, and getting back on the floor and just kind of putting some of the past mistakes behind him was big. And then against Vanderbilt, he was awesome. And I think he was Arkansas's second leading scorer at halftime, had 8 points. I think he really likes dunking on Vanderbilt players, because he did that last year in Bud Walton. Like, he put a kid on a poster last year in Bud Walton. We got the picture somewhere in our photo shelter account. But he did that again on Wednesday. And by halftime, he scored a season-high 8 points and dished out a couple of assists. I think Jimmy Witt knocked down a jumper on one of Chaney's assists really close to halftime. And Reggie's played his tail off. And I mentioned this in my story. His game against Vanderbilt kind of continued this trend of him playing well when he sees the floor for 20 or more minutes. He's done it 10 times in his career. In those 10 games, he's averaging almost 10 points, 5.5 rebounds, and has blocked, I think, 22 shots, and he's finished with 4 or more assists 3 times. That's really productive. Like, that's really good stuff. And I think it comes down to confidence with Reggie. And more to that, I think anytime Reggie gets on the floor and he has something positive happen kind of early in his run, then we tend to see Reggie play pretty well. If things kind of go poorly in the first couple minutes he's on the floor, we can kind of see him disappear a little bit, or, you know, maybe negatively impact the game. But I didn't really see much negative out of Reggie against Vanderbilt, and that was huge. I had friends texting me during the game talking about how, you know, just important that stretch was for Reggie just going into Kentucky.
Yeah, now you'll have a fresh Bailey to compete against Kentucky as well, because he didn't play just a whole lot. Let's see how many minutes. Bailey only had 18 minutes, so Chaney had more minutes with 21 than Bailey did.
I think Adrio fouled out.
Adrio, he did foul out.
He was getting picked on by the refs a little bit, it seemed like.
Yeah, he got picked on by a Vanderbilt player too at one point.
Yeah, that's a segment we'll call You Hate to See It. You hate to see it, Scotty, but he got dunk eye there for a second. A guy just rose up and
After the game he said it comes with it. Like he's been on the good end of that with the Valpo game where he just stuffed a kid at the top of the square. And you know, sooner or later, it's all gonna even out. So it just kind of comes with it, and you like to see that attitude too, because he wasn't shying away from trying to block the dunk against Vanderbilt. But sometimes you can't come out on the positive end of things all the time,
especially when you're as tall as Bailey is playing the post. Bailey has extreme leaping ability.
Yeah, he's freaky athletic for sure.
But when you're playing the post for that long, you're going to get somebody that's going to have the momentum and the height and the length to get over you.
Yep.
And so it's going to happen. So I like you said, I like the attitude that he has of it happens, it'll be all right, and I'll move on from it. All right. To break up the monotony just a little bit here, Scotty, before we get to this Kentucky preview, we're going to play a quick little game. You ready?
Let's do it.
What shirt will Musselman wear next to the press conference? I had a running bet, and mine, I was saying for the past two, I thought that he'd bring out a Kettle Brand potato chips shirt, and he surprised me with the Raising Cane's after the Hogs hit the Cane's Challenge yesterday to get
thanks
that
to
the 75 points thanks to Witt,
yes,
and Chaney.
Yes.
Both of those guys ending with the last 4 points. And then the best part about it is when they had 73 after Witt got to 30, that they needed two more points, and the entire student section is in the stands holding up two fingers, going, two, we need two.
Yeah, those kids need some free food, man.
They deserved it. And I don't know if you've noticed, but they did raise the price or raise the score, because it used to be 70. It used to be if you got 70. And I think this is only, the third or fourth time that the Hogs have hit Canes this basketball season. It used to be every single time. If they're at if the Razorbacks were at Bud Walton Arena and got the win, then you could expect Canes. But it hasn't been that way this year with, I think, the different offense that Musselman's running, and then the raising of the limit from 70 to 75 has hurt a little bit. But he came in with the Cane shirt.
That shirt was something else too, man.
It was the dog.
It was a Labrador puppy with a red bandana on, and it had the Raising Cane's logo on it.
But all of his shirts, no matter what logo they have in the middle, whether it's Taco Bell, Pepsi, or whatever, it always has that hog in the top right corner. These are custom made for him.
Yeah, they're sharp. I don't know what t-shirt he's going to wear next. If Arkansas wins, if Arkansas wins on Saturday, he's going to be on cloud nine, because his team's going to be in the top 25 for the first time in more than 2 years. But if they lose, I would kind of expect him to maybe just come in wearing whatever he did on the sideline. But if Arkansas wins, he might come in there shirtless. I mean, we've seen him shirtless,
yeah,
not at Arkansas, but at Nevada after they won, I think, a Mountain West Conference championship. He's running around the floor without a shirt on. I know his wife doesn't like it, but it's fun. I don't know. I might go with Tyson again, or maybe Taco Bell. I think those are two good options for
going for some repeats.
Yeah.
I put out a poll somewhere in a conversation I had with some friends, and so I'm trying to find that poll to see. I was trying to find other sponsors that we have, because that's what you got. He came into Canes. I was thinking we have Yarnell's as a sponsor that he hasn't come in yet. He's coming in Tyson. I said Kettle Brand chips. He hasn't done JB Hunt yet. Whataburger, when the Whataburger fry shuffle or whatever, he hasn't done Whataburger yet. So those are just some that I could come up with off of the top of my head. It's almost time for him to repeat. They've got to be running out of official sponsors somewhere in there, right?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to run out of ideas for t-shirts, though. That doesn't seem like, Arkansas comes up with so many unique, shooting shirts for games. Like, almost every game, it's something different. And I don't think, I'm kind of going back on what I said. I don't think we'll probably see the same thing that we have in the past. He'll probably shake it up. If he walks in there with a Whataburger shirt, he's going to make me have to go get some after the game.
That's the whole goal.
That is the whole goal.
That's true. Marketing's working.
He's so good at marketing. I mean, we knew that coming in. Like, we knew that he was so good at social media. We knew that that was his shtick at Nevada, and he figured out that that's a way that he could go about things. And we also knew that the grad transfer market was him. Well, he's come in, and he's shown that he's not going to just stop because he's at a different program, and the optics of things may be just slightly different. He's on social media. After the game, we were in the press room writing up whatever. We're trying to post whatever to our different variant. All the media people are trying to post to their various media websites. And all of a sudden, we just hear yelling. And it sounds like it's coming from down the hall.
And I got up. I was in the middle of transcribing quotes. And I get up and I peek my head down the hallway and I don't see anybody. And as soon as I sit back down, I hear the yelling again. And I'm like, I'm not getting back up to see what it was, but...
And the weird thing is we're not really near the Arkansas locker room where we transcribe in the basement of Bud Walton Arena, but we are pretty close to the Vanderbilt locker room. And I was thinking, Vanderbilt got beat by 20. There's no way that they're celebrating like that. And they should already have been gone, in all honesty. So I was trying to figure out what it is. Well, check Twitter this morning and you found out what it is.
Yeah, so Musselman, Anthony Ruta, Pat Ackerman, Musselman's two boys, Hayes Myers and Riley Hall are standing right at the front of the student section, and they're just cheering and they're holding up different signs. One of them says, "Hey, Dickie V, can I get a picture?" Ruta is holding a sign that says, "And must we trust?" And Riley Hall is holding a sign that's got ESPN in bold red letters on the left side of the poster, and it reads, "Eric sips Pepsi nightly."
Perfect.
And so they're just getting everybody hyped for the Kentucky game, like 20 minutes after the Vanderbilt game ended. Doesn't stop.
That's a marketing mind right there, though. And that's Muss's mind in the fact of that he's even instilled in his players of when you come off the court after a Vanderbilt game or after a Montana State game, your next opponent is up on the whiteboard. You're going to know their strengths and weaknesses. You're going to leave Bud Walton Arena on Wednesday night prepared for your game on Saturday. Now, you're not going to be as prepared as he expects you to be when you get to practice and what you're going to do in practice, but you're going to know at least the five starters that Kentucky's going to run out there and their top eight guys. You're going to know something about them, and you're going to leave with that in your mind. That is Eric Musselman to the fullest, preparing for everything in marketing or in-game strategy. That just oozes over in his program. It just seeps into every single facet, and you can tell by the way that they prepared.
Reggie Chaney came into the post game last night. I think somebody asked him just how excited is the team to be getting ready to play, you know, maybe the biggest game that we've seen in Bud Walton Arena in a long time. And Reggie's like, "Yeah, well, we know that they like to dribble drive." I'm like, so they're already like beating those team tendencies into those guys' heads. And they're not even out of their uniform yet from the game they just played. They're already getting them ready for Saturday. So it's been pretty neat to kind of follow that.
Speaking of Saturday, Musselman was asked at the press conference if he expects the atmosphere to be the best that he has witnessed ever. And this is a guy that's coached in the NBA, coached multiple teams. He was with his dad when they were coaching the Timberwolves. Coached all around and taken Nevada to multiple NCAA tournaments. This is what he said.
Yeah, probably. Hopefully we'll give our, you know, like it's up to your, you know, it's up to the players to create the energy.
You think that man is excited for Saturday night, Scotty?
I think so. Maybe just a little bit.
If he thinks that it's going to be the best environment, he's already hyped it up. He's hyped it up on Twitter. Everybody is, I mean, they're going to tailgate before this game. It's a 3:00 tip. Dickie V is going to be in town. It's on ESPN. The hype is all there. Now, Kentucky didn't really come through on their end, losing on a buzzer beater to South Carolina in a game that they held a 15-point lead, did they not?
Yeah, I think it was a 14-point lead in the second half and lost on a, it was really kind of a BS buzzer beater, banked in three at the buzzer. But
Arkansas has been the benefactor of one of those this year,
right,
too.
Right, so. Exactly. That kind of thing happens.
But all of this momentum, and Kentucky will still be ranked in the top 10 because the new AP poll doesn't come out until later after the game. They won't come out until Monday morning, so they'll still be in the top 10. And you have an opportunity. You know, Vanderbilt wasn't a quadrant one win. You have good wins over Indiana. You've beaten a good Georgia Tech team, but those are not great teams. This is your litmus test right now. This is what you can compare to. This is what everybody in the SEC compares themselves to. If you can beat Kentucky, then you are a top team in this league. Do you want to be a top team in this league? You want to be top four? Go out there and compete against Kentucky. That's what the opportunity is presented in front of you today, or on Saturday.
Right. And I think, gosh, I can't remember who it was after, which player it was after Arkansas beat Ole Miss. It may have been Isaiah Joe. He said, we've got a motto on this team, and it's you don't lose at home and you don't lose two in a row. So Arkansas went to Ole Miss on Saturday, backs really against the wall for maybe the first real, for the first point in the season, like it was for real. Like you might be seeing this team slip a little bit, but it got a terrific effort in like the last 15 minutes at Ole Miss. You prevent the second consecutive loss from happening. Now you're back at home. You take care of business against Vanderbilt, which you should have. And now you've got another chance to protect your home floor and notch a huge win on your resume. That would put Arkansas at 15-2. Think about that, 15-2.
In Musselman's first year.
And we're approaching late January. That's a pretty big deal. And then you'd move to 4-1 in league play, and nobody could take that win from you at that point. Nobody. And I'm really looking forward to it. And Kulo Garland's been on Twitter saying every seat needs to be filled in Bud this Saturday. And I don't think there's going to be.
I don't think there's going to be an empty one. All right, as we wrap it up here on the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America, Seth Campbell, joined alongside Scotty Borderline. You can follow him on Twitter. Scotty, drop your handle.
It's at NWA Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-I-E.
He gives you good information all throughout the games, and he'll also tweet out his stories there if you want to follow him on WholeHogSports.com, too. You can find him there. All right, give me what you think from this Kentucky game. What are going to be, I guess, your keys to this game, Scotty?
Ooh, I think Arkansas is like, the crowd on Saturday is going to be phenomenal. Like, before the game, you're going to be able to feel the anticipation in the arena. Imagine when everybody gets into the arena, like, even in pregame warmups, there's not going to be many people sitting down. Like, people are going to be really antsy to get this thing going. Arkansas's got to give the crowd a reason to really get into it. You got to make shots early. You got to defend. You got to rebound. Prevent second chance points for Kentucky, because they are monsters on the glass. Like I said earlier, EJ Montgomery and Nick Richards are a handful. And then Kentucky's also got some really good guards. They've got great guard play. Emmanuel Quickley and Ashton Hagans are two of the best guards in the league, bar none. You just got to give the crowd a reason to get into the game and be a factor. And I think Musselman kind of alluded to that when someone asked him, do you expect the Kentucky crowd to be the best atmosphere that you've coached in? And he said he does anticipate it being loud and does anticipate it being a just a great atmosphere. But again, they have to give the crowd a reason to get loud. And I think getting off to a quick start and then just kind of maintaining your energy and intensity, I think that's it. Got to continue to take care of the ball. Arkansas has been taking care of the ball great in conference. You got to keep doing that. Ashton Hagans is going to make things hard because he's defensively, he's going to turn more guys over than the average defender. So those are just a few things. You just can't get bullied on the glass. And second chance points, I think, are going to be big. Because I think if even though Kentucky blew a double-digit lead at South Carolina, I can't, you know, if Kentucky gets up double figures, I don't know that Arkansas is built to come back from a double-digit deficit against that kind of team. So I think just preventing just kind of easy buckets, I think that's going to be huge.
The Whole Hog Podcast is produced and edited for Airship by me, Seth Campbell. Special shout-outs to Jerry Tipton, Matt Jones, and Scotty Borderline. You can read more from Jerry on the Lexington Herald website. You can read more from Scotty and Matt on WholeHogSports.com. If you like the podcast and want to hear more great Razorback content, make sure to subscribe so you won't miss upcoming news. Theme music is by Silent Partners. I'm Seth Campbell for Whole Hog Sports. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week.